science enthusiasts. My name is Jason Sikowski. I'm your host. I'm a high school chemistry teacher, but you probably know our dog, Bunsen. He's the Twitter science dog. This show takes what's best about dog Twitter, the fun and the empathy found there, but also swirls it together with science and education. Every week, we'll take a deep dive into some interesting thing happening in science in the world, as well as look into the world of science around pets. We also have an expert on every single episode that we have an exciting chat with about what they're studying and the impacts for our society. This is the Science Podcast.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Science Podcast this week. I hope this podcast is finding everybody healthy and everybody safe. It looks like the protests that have happened in the United States have, they haven't stopped, but they've become a lot more peaceful. They have also spread everywhere. So if you're an American listening to the Science Podcast, there have been, in our province of Alberta, huge protests in our two major cities to the north and south of us in support of Black Lives Matter and in support of reforming police brutality and violence. In our city, Red Deer, there have also been three protests, actually back to back to back to back. This is a really hard time for people who in the Black community and other people that have been subject to racism and injustice. I'd like to always think on the bright side that this has created a lot of really good discussions. And in Canada, some really hard discussions. People in Canada who don't have blinders on know that Canada has a really dark and terrible past with its treatment of the First Nations Métis and Inuit people, as well as we have racism and police brutality in Canada too. Not all police officers are bad. Not all police officers are racist. Not all police officers cause brutality. So those hard conversations are making Canada look at itself. So the movement that was caused by the death of George Floyd, that horrible murder in the United States, it's caused a fire and it's spread to us in Canada. And you can see the protests from all over the world. Everywhere in the world has to look at itself, I think, and have some really difficult discussions about how do we move forward? How do we treat people better? If dogs have a life that's full of love, they give that love back to whoever. A lot of our pets love us without conditions. And maybe that's something that we need to look at. Like, why are there areas where there is such hate and we treat people so differently? I'm very proud that the podcast allows people a platform, especially our guests, to talk about that. That's the heavy part. In the news and in other political podcasts and other topical podcasts, I'm sure you'll get your fill of what's going to be happening in the next 3 weeks with all of the protests, but that's the Science Podcast spin. In science news this week, we're going to take a look at artificial red blood cells. Crazy. In dog science, we're going to take a look at some reporting on what dogs find scary, which is kind of pertinent because we have Beaker. She's home with us. She's adorable. We have been spamming social media with pictures of her. We will have stories about her and maybe a little bit about Bunsen too at the end of the podcast. Our guest this week is Dr. Corey Evans, who studies fish morphology and has been to the Amazon, nearly killed in the river, and specializes in the electric fish there. Zappy zappy, so cool. Hey Bunsen, what do you get when you cross an electric fish in a sponge? A shock absorber. Okay, on with the show. Because there's no time like science time. This week in science news, we're going to talk about something kind of crazy. Artificial red blood cells. What? Well, before we get to the actual article, here's my little story preamble. I got some feedback from people on social media that they prefer this part to the actual science news. Sorry, we still have to do the science news. My story about red blood cells and how it relates to science is carbon monoxide. I was teaching, this would have been about 7 years ago, a group of grade 11s and grade 9s, and there was a sister in either grade. And one day, both of them were gone, and which isn't weird. Sometimes parents take kids out of school for whatever reason. Maybe they had their, maybe they had their dentist appointment. But these two girls were gone for a while. They were gone for 1 or 2 days. And after about the second day, I was like, well, I got to call home and see what's up. Didn't get any message. Couldn't get it through to anybody. I waited while I was like, maybe they took an impromptu vacation. That happens more often than you would think as a teacher, where some kids just up and are gone. You're like, where'd they go? And then some kid you find out from later are like, oh yeah, they went to Mexico for 2 weeks. I'm like, well, I guess they're going to be way behind when they get back. Anyways, that wasn't the case. The family got poisoned by carbon monoxide. Something went wrong in their house with the air intake. So to give you an idea, most homes in Alberta are heated in the winter with natural gas, methane, CH4. When you don't have enough oxygen, the carbon dioxide that's normally produced in a carbohydrate combustion is turned into carbon monoxide. Carbon monoxide binds to red blood cells more readily than oxygen. So this family nearly died. Had it not been for one of the younger girl having enough kind of like with it as they were getting poisoned to call the grandparents for help, the whole family probably would have died. So it was super scary. And I was really happy when I got those kids back in my class, but they were out for 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks, something like that. Very, very serious. On to the science article. One of the big holy grails in biotechnology is to be able to create something biological from basically things that aren't biological, like being able to create, for example, a heart from nothing. Now, we have artificial hearts, of course, but like an actual organic heart. We're going to have to shrink down thousands, millions of times to get to a red blood cell. But up until now, success has not been really amazing with all of this stuff. There's been a lot of failures, a lot of hope. They're getting close with some things. And red blood cells was what this group of researchers tackled. Red blood cells need to be bendy, right? They need to be like, ooh, oogly googly, so they can get through capillaries and like, you know, little shimmy shimmy small areas. They need to be able to last a while and not get destroyed by the body's immune system. And they also be able to actually do what they're supposed to do, absorb oxygen and move it around the body. Now, crash course. If it's been a while since you've taken biology and you need a little bit of brush up on red blood cells, red blood cells are they kind of look like a donut, not a Timbit for Canadians, but like a donut. They take oxygen from the lungs and deliver it around the body. It's basically a specialized cell because it has this amazing iron-containing protein that traps, the protein's called hemoglobin, and it traps oxygen. Also, red blood cells are coated with proteins on the surface that stops them from being identified as being bad news by the body and hunted down by macrophages and destroyed. Red blood cells travel everywhere, right? So basically, they have to be okay in every single part of your body from the defenses within the body to keep things from wrecking us, right? So they've got these specialized proteins which keep them from being identified. Also, red blood cells are hella flexible. They can bend and fold and squeeze through tiny openings. So, two scientists that are the head of this research team, Wei Zhu and Jeff Brinkler, made artificial red blood cells with the same properties as red blood cells. Now, they didn't just stop there. They augmented them. They added like +5 to drug delivery and made some of them magnetic, and they made some of them invisible to bacteria. Crazy. Like, this is next level biotech engineering. This is a huge deal. We'll get to the end of the study. This is not ready for mainstream. It's not like you can go to the blood bank, you vampires out there, and get yourself some synthetic magnetic blood or something like that. There's a long ways to go. But man, can you imagine being able to make synthetic blood without the need to? Obviously, it's great for people that donate blood, but they're always, in Canada at least, I don't know everywhere else in the world, they're always calling for blood donations because in times of crisis, especially around long weekends in Canada, there's more chance of really bad accidents. We need the blood. And can you imagine just being able to have an unlimited supply of amazing blood, like not just normal blood, but like augmented blood? Okay, was the team successful? Kind of. They actually were kind of successful. How'd they do this? How do you make an artificial red blood cell? First, you have to take a real red blood cell. So you need the perfect red blood cell. I don't know how you get that. You look at a bunch of them and you're like, yeah, I like this one. You get a whole bunch of these perfect red blood cells. And then they coated them with silica. Not a good idea to start with. You can't have silica coated red blood cells. They're not going to be able to do anything. They can't bind oxygen. But what the silica allowed the team to do was to layer differently charged polymers around the silica. Then a chemical was added to remove the silica. That left behind, guess what? The polymer layers. This made the red blood cells bendy. So this was the big breakthrough, right? Polymers like plastics do, they're bendy. And the polymer is probably not a plastic polymer, but it's a polymer. Then after they made them bendy, they coated this bendy capsule with actual red blood cell membranes, which can be made. And they found they wound up with cells that were of similar size and shape and charge, so which means that they could attract oxygen. They also ran these artificial red blood cells through models, like little tiny capillaries, to see if they'd get wrecked, and they didn't. And then they put them in mice. So did these red blood cells work in a biological system? And the answer is they did. Shockingly, they worked in the biological system. The red blood cells that were made by this the team of scientists lasted for 2 days without any harmful effects to the host. They also had augmented cells in the group. So they had some red blood cells that were super hemoglobin cells. So they like pumped them full of hemoglobin so they could really bind oxygen well. Some were full of anti-cancer drugs. Some they actually made magnetic with nanoparticles so they could clip stuff to them like backpacks to move it around the body. It all worked. It was totally successful. They also were able to use some red blood cells artificially, these artificial, basically drone red blood cells, as decoys when bacteria wanted to harm them. So the bacteria would be really disappointed. It was going after a red blood cell and boof, no, it just ate a polymer. Oh, now there's a whole bunch more work to do. Like I said at the start of this, before we can start pumping this stuff into humans, this only lasted 2 days in mice, not humans. They have to make sure it's not toxic for more than 2 days. So they have a long ways to go, but this first little step is very hopeful. It's really cutting edge nanotech biohacking. That's amazing. I mean, those are a bunch of words that probably were meaningless 15 or 20 years ago. So the team of scientists is really excited in their next round where they're going to be looking at the artificial cells in medical applications. So while they were able to pump some of them full of anti-cancer drugs, the next series of tests is to see if they can, in mice, get those anti-cancer drugs to actually affect a positive outcome. So exciting. This article is from ACS Nano. It's a journal just about nanotechnology. The really, really small stuff. So cool. Biohack our bodies. If anybody watched True Blood out there, so people who are, you know, the vampires among us that are listening to the podcast, you're only a couple years away, probably longer, from having your own artificial red blood cell drink. That's science news for this week. This week in pet science, we're going to talk about fear. Now, on the subject of fear, we've spoken before that Bunsen is still not too sure about the wheelbarrow. And having a new puppy at home is adorable because we found a couple things that she's afraid of and what some of the things she's not afraid of. She is not super thrilled with this pink bin that we have, but she is unafraid of Bunsen, and their size difference is crazy right now because she's so new to us. If you saw the pictures on social media, she is the tiniest thing compared to how giant Bunsen is. Like, it is crazy different. And she goes right up to him. She tries to play with him. She stole his Kong. She ran right at him and stole his Kong. And he's like, oh man, that's too bad. He's so gentle. So fear in dogs is a big deal because it's related to public safety. Dogs that have stranger directed aggression or with kids, they can actually have a decreased lifespan. Dogs don't seek out fear like humans do. Humans go on roller coasters and we go to haunted houses, but dogs don't do that. A really interesting study in 2012 from Michelle Wan at Columbia University found that just about everybody from very experienced professional dog trainers to the person on the street was able with a high degree of accuracy to pick out a dog that was happy. But finding a dog that was fearful was completely different. The professionals were a lot better identifying dogs that were fearful than random dog owners who had no experience. Of the non-professionals, people who have owned a dog did better than random Joe people off the street. If we think about fear from a dog's perspective, it's an emotional reaction. It's something from their environment, a stimulus that leads them to protect or defend themselves. Dogs are descended from wolves, right? And wolves needed fear to protect themselves. It was a cascade effect. If a wolf got afraid, a whole bunch of different mobilizations in their body occurred. There are hormones that are released, heart rate goes up, eyes dilate, just like with humans, but fear has to serve a purpose. You can't be scared of everything. You have to be scared in the right circumstances to protect their life. So overall, if you're wondering what a scared or fearful dog looks like, fearful dogs reduce their body size. They crouch, they flatten their ears, they hold their tail low. Now, there are some things that dogs do that are fearful that may not necessarily be fearful, but these are some that go with it. Shaking and yawning, if they drool lots, if they pant lots, or if they start to vocalize, those are also associated with fear. But some of those aren't, right? A yawning dog, just because your dog is yawning doesn't mean it's scared of something. But in conjunction with crouching, flattening their ears, and holding their tails in a low position, it is. Now, because dog breeds look very differently, take Bunsen, for example. To determine if he's scared or if his ears are upset, it's really hard to tell because his head is so huge and he's got giant, adorable, floppy ears. So it's not like he's got pointy ears like a shepherd where you can see them go back. A second article also goes into how sometimes because you are around your dog and you love your dog so much, you can maybe miss those fear response behaviors. A study from the Antakya University in Turkey identified something really surprising, that dog owners and non-dog owners did differently with pictures or clips of fearful dogs interacting with kids. And non-dog owners picked up on the sketchy behavior right away. Dog lovers just assume that all dogs are also like their own dogs, good dogs. So when a dog is around a kid, the dog lovers, the dog owners, were most more likely to think this is a normal good scenario. Whereas people that didn't own a dog were able to see, whoa, that dog is acting strange. Get that kid out of there. It is super easy to be trained to spot fear. That's what the study went on to this. The study from Turkey went on to say is that they then trained the dog owners to identify different aspects of fear response in dogs, and they got way better at it. So much better. This is something that I wanted to just mention because we have a big dog, Bunsen, and now we have a little teeny tiny puppy. And while we trust Bunsen with many things, we know that he's huge. And Bernese Mountain Dogs have a giant mouth and a powerful jaw and a powerful body. So we have been really, really careful with him around Beaker just because, you know, he's an animal. He's a loving animal, but we don't want him to hurt Beaker, and Beaker's so tiny. So in that same situation, you have to think about it from with kids, with little babies and everybody, that just because your pet is you know, fairly safe, you need to be watching them. And for the most part, Bunsen has been really good with Beaker. He's had some like tensing when Beaker's come close, so we've been really watching that. But that's apparently, as the research says, when you're introducing a puppy to a new dog, pretty normal. To close, if you could personify what type of movie a dog would watch, a horror movie would be lowest on its list of things a dog would like to watch. Probably they would love romantic comedies where everybody in the end has learned a valuable lesson and goes home happy. That's Pet Science for this week. Before we get to the interview section, I just want to tell everybody about how the podcast is made possible. It's made possible by listeners just like you. The podcast will always be free to download. You're never going to have to worry about paying for it. This has been one of the greatest decisions of my life to start this podcast, just from personally and professionally how much I've grown getting to talk to all these amazing people and getting to know people who listen to the show. But the show isn't free to run, and if you want to support it, head over to the Patreon page at patreon.com/Bunsenburner. You'll notice that there's different tiers of support, and the lowest tier is only $5 a month. At 4 shows a month and $5 a month, that's not that expensive for good educational entertainment. We also send out swag to our patrons and give them awesome patron-only content and early access, like getting onto the website early for Bunsen, and top-tier patrons got a Bunsen stuffy shipped to them. The link is in the show notes if you want to head over there and check it out. Thanks for listening, guys. On to the interview section. On the Science Podcast, in the Ask an Expert section, I'm super excited to talk to Dr. Corey Evans,
who knows everything, well, lots of stuff, about fish, but especially electric fish. How are you doing today, Corey?
I am doing great. How are you doing?
I'm great. Just so people know where you're calling in from, Dr. Evans, where are you in the world right now?
Right now, I'm in Nashville, Tennessee.
Okay. And this podcast won't come out for, you know, a few weeks after we chat, but are you coping okay with the whole coronavirus crisis?
You know, I am coping probably as best as anyone else is coping. What I will say is that I was driving. I had to take a long drive, and I ran into a gas station to get some gas, and they had hand sanitizer. It was incredible.
Right.
I haven't seen hand sanitizer in weeks, so that was nice. So I did stock up on hand sanitizer. So that that if we're going to talk about coping, I'm coping better now.
Gotcha. Were you guys in your area, were you out of the same stuff that Canada was out of? Like, obviously hand sanitizer, but toilet paper as well? Like, we were out of toilet paper for weeks.
Why are we out of toilet paper during a pandemic?
Yes. So it's the same thing. It's the same thing for you, hey?
I don't get it. I don't understand.
I don't know. People are home. They're using twice as much because they're not at work. I don't know. It was crazy.
Yeah, that's nuts.
We have a bunch of local breweries in Alberta, and they, one of them that's in near where we live, it's a brewery called the Troubled Monk. Uh-huh. They do like craft beer, right? They make really good beer, and they switched their entire production to make hand sanitizer because they have the ingredients to make it.
That's awesome.
And they talked to the University of Alberta, some chemists up there, and they figured out how to make some. So now they've been making giant 4-liter jugs of hand sanitizer. So
doing God's work.
Yeah. You shouldn't drink that stuff, but you know, it definitely has helped.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, okay. So let's talk a little bit about you. You've got such an exciting area of research. Can you talk to everybody a little bit about maybe your background to get to where you are today with what you're studying?
Basically right now I study the evolution of vertebrate skulls, and I specialize on fishes. And man, I am crazy about fishes, and it's been that way since I was, you know, I want to say 14 years old, actually. And it's kind of been this, it's kind of funny because I remember, you can ask anybody who's known me since I was a kid, you can ask Karina. It's really funny because ever since I was a kid, I used to tell people, it's like, I want to work with fish, I want to be a marine biologist. And it kind of honestly shook out that way, which is usually not how it works. But it was cool.
That's so exciting for you. That's awesome.
Yeah. And it was like, it shook out to a precision that I didn't even anticipate. I was like, I want to work on South American fishes. And it literally shook out that way. From 14 years old, I had always wanted to travel to the Amazon River, work in the Amazon River, and catch fish, and do cool and just study, you know, ecology mostly back then of fishes. And it really kind of shook out that way. And it's really a blessing. It's a surprise. It's a blessing that some like North Philadelphia kid can actually go do that stuff. So it's been pretty cool.
Now, did you have a lot of drive when you were a teenager to get as far as you did? Like, obviously you have to do fairly well in school. You know, you can't be too much of a slacker.
You'd be so surprised. Listen.
Yeah.
Did you watch Pokemon at all growing up or anything like that?
I'm a little too old for Pokemon, but I absolutely know what it is because my youngest son and my oldest son went through the Pokemon craze. Yeah.
So the main character had this, you know, because Pokemon battle each other, right? So the main character had this one Pokemon called Charizard, which was his strongest Pokemon. But Charizard only did the things that he wanted to do. So if he needed Charizard to fight somebody and Charizard wasn't interested, Charizard would just lay on his back and go to sleep. That was me. That was me throughout the majority of my academic career until probably like midway through undergrad. But in high school, I was a massive slacker. I was athletically gifted, sort of, I guess. So I played a lot of sports, and I only cared about my science classes, did not care about math because somehow no one had ever told me that the two were really linked. I was a big slacker. I actually finished high school with a 2.4 GPA. But I tested, I do really well on standardized tests. So I was able to get into college and all of that.
So it was your passion that pulled you through then.
Right? Absolutely. Because the whole time I was slacking in school, I would come home and I'd have like 8 fish tanks going in my room. 8 fish tanks going in my room, like detailed list of the fishes that I have, where they're from originally, like, you know, where their species can be found, ecological notes, who can go with who, what eats what. So I was working spreadsheets. I had like a hit list of fishes I wanted to add to the tank and all kinds of stuff. But then I would go to school and slack. It's kind of funny.
Oh, it reminds me of one of my favorite students I had a couple of years ago that was kind of a slacker, but was an absolute genius with coho. Like, he just knew everything about Atlantic salmon. Mm-hmm. And that's what he wanted to study. He wanted to get out there on the west coast of Canada and study the salmon. And that's where he is right now working towards. So he's going to have an amazing career, I guarantee you.
Yeah, that's, I mean, and that's incredible.
Did you go to the Amazon to study some stuff in your educational journey?
Many times, yeah.
Wow.
And it was cool because basically when I joined that lab, the department head, he said, yeah, if you join the Albert Lab, I believe his graduate students go to South America very frequently. And I was like, what? And lo and behold, and what a perfect system. So I was broke, right? Like I was already a broke grad student, but I showed up broke. Like I didn't have a lot of money. But working in South America, especially Peru, was surprisingly cheap for a graduate student. Our first flight, at least, to Peru, and obviously I'll get to the Amazon part, but I really need to talk about how amazing it is to do work in a system like this. Our first flight to Iquitos, Peru, was $500 round trip out of Miami.
Wow.
It's incredible, right? Direct flight.
I don't think I can fly to another province one way for $500 in Canada.
That was incredible. And it was like a sliver of time where like the flights were cheap and we were able to get a lot of work done. So, but yeah, so the first time going to the Amazon, and ever since I've been back, the Amazon to me has been this massive, just mysterious river. And it's really, you know, I hate to personify it or, you know, but I feel like it's got its own personality. It's wildly unpredictable. You could be on that river one second and everything's fine. And then the next second, it's like raging storms. It's crazy. So yeah, but I love that river and it's got nothing but mysteries in it. And it's just been so cool. I love that place.
That's so exciting. Were you down there doing your research on those electric fish? The what you had a scientific term for them. I apologize.
Neotropical. So that just means neotropical. Yeah. So the tropical band in South America. So yeah, neotropical electric fishes. Yeah. So that's what I was down there doing. I went down there to study skull shape evolution, and I was looking for the relationship between skull shape and trophic ecology using these electric fishes. So I was using stabilized stub analysis, which is a method that allows you to determine the trophic position of a particular organism by taking a piece of its body, usually a muscle clip, and we can combust it and we can tell what this animal has roughly been feeding on for the past 3 or 4 months, depending on tissue turnover rate. And it works surprisingly well, right? And you can do it on people. You'd usually find that they eat corn or some cornmeal substitute. But yeah, and basically I use that method to figure out what the trophic ecology was for all the electric fishes that lived in the Amazon River Basin. And then I look for relationships between skull shape and diet.
Oh, that's so interesting. Wow. So yeah, did you have to catch the electric fish? I would assume you'd have
sure
to.
Did. It's so cool.
I'm just fascinated by this. Anything you want to talk to us about electric fish, we'd love to hear it.
All right. So since you brought it up, let's talk about how we catch these fish, right? So the first time we went to the Amazon River, we had our own kind of idea of how we wanted to catch the fish. We had big trawl nets. We were going to drop them on the bottom of the Amazon, the highest diversity place for freshwater fishes in the world. All we have to do is drop a net and catch them, right? So that's what we thought. We dragged these nets on the bottom. It's our very first trip. And we caught maybe 4 fish out of the largest river on the planet. So we were doing something wrong. So one of my lab mates drummed up this connection with some of the local aquarium fishermen. And the way they fish is entirely different and like way more awesome. So we start fishing with those guys. And they run these small, long wooden boats, 2 of them, with this massive net between them. This net is about the size, I'm going to say it's about the size of a football field maybe, and about 30 feet deep. And they run it between two wooden boats, and they like run along the sides of the boats to make sure the net doesn't get tangled and stuff. And using that method, you can pull up about 1,000 fish per pool, per net pool. So that changed my dissertation dramatically. It was like I could get like, you know, sample sizes that I needed in hours. It was insane. So I got the sample sizes that I needed, and then I was getting stuff for side projects and all kinds of things. And the funny thing about this method is that you really, honestly, you never know what you're going to pull up. Some electric fishes, you know, there are places where you know you can catch them. So we discovered that there's this, there's a couple of species that eat almost exclusively the scales and tails of other electric fishes. And that's it, right? So they eat scales and tails, and they hide out in these places where there's a lot of current, where the white and black water mix, there's a lot of current, and there's a lot of like confusing conductivity. And they hang out there, and we think that they ambush predators there. They ambush their prey there. So we can catch them there. But we also caught a new species of fish. So, to be honest, we've caught several undescribed species of electric fish in the Amazon. But I remember distinctly catching one of them in the Amazon because like a storm was brewing. And I will tell you, the Amazon's almost killed me maybe 4 or 5 times. So every time I'm on that river, I'm very wary. It's like just about every time I'm going out on that river, it's figured out a new and creative way to take me out. So I was like, let's get on this river, admire it, catch the fish, go back into town and like have cocktails. And that's that. Like stay off this river. Like this river is not for fun.
I'm just like, is it deep in places, Dr. Evans? Like, is that why it was dangerous or?
In the current, it's deep and the current is really, really strong. And the problem is you have no idea where it's deep because it's super muddy. So you have no idea where it's deep unless you have a radar or sonar or other. Yeah, so that was one of the ways the Amazon almost got me. But but basically, a storm had started kicking up, and the fishermen I was working with, they were like, hey, look, we've been catching this weird fish that we, you know, we don't really have a name for it, and I don't think you guys have a name for it, and we know where it is. And they had been looking for it, and the storm starts kicking up, and it starts raining. And I was like, guys, let's go back into town. Because normally the fish, like my fishermen, they're like, yo, once it starts raining, you got to pay us extra. So I was like, nah, let's go home. And they're like, wait, let's run. They're like, let's run this net one more time. And I was sitting there like, I don't want to do this. The Amazon's finally going to get me. We run that net one time over a floating kind of grass bed. And we catch a gigantic undescribed species of electric fish. And I got to describe it and I got to name it. And that was crazy. On the very last net of the trip. And I've actually been able to name, I've named two new species of fish, one after the T-Rex and one after my mom, that was fun.
Well, that's so exciting. On the same kind of topic of electric fish, do you have to worry about getting shocked by them?
No. So these animals are weakly electric. The only strongly electric neotropical fish is the electric eel, which is a strongly electric fish. That fish can do some serious damage if it gets you. And they use their weak electric signals for communication, navigation, and prey detection, basically. But yeah, so when I say that fish was big, it was about a foot and a half long, which I don't know what that converts to in Canadian.
Foot and a half, not a little bit bigger than a Subway sub. Were these crazy looking fish? Like I'd imagine when you would pull like this kind of dragnet, you'd get some wild looking stuff in there. Did you, when you pulled it up and you say it was like a surprise every time, where some of the times you were like, oh my goodness, look what we have today.
Man, listen, I have been working with these fish for so long that they began to look normal to me. But whenever another ichthyologist, another fish biologist gets in front of them, every one of these fish looks freaky. Okay. So these animals live... Every one of them, they all look weird, freaky. And now that I've started moving into other fish groups and now I'm beginning to appreciate just how weird these ones are. These fish live in the bottom of the Amazon, right? And it's pitch black because it's super muddy. So no sunlight reaches even probably past 2 inches in the water column. So these fishes live in complete darkness their entire lives. They have teeny, teeny eyes, teeny, tiny eyes. Sometimes the eyes are completely reduced and they're asymmetrical in the face relative to one another. It's a mess. A lot of these fishes are depigmented because there's no light. So why produce pigment? And they have these long, crazy snouts. Some of them have these gnarly teeth. Some of them grow gnarly teeth during the breeding season to fight each other, and others grow pelican beaks during the breeding season to fight each other. It's mayhem down there. And that's just the electric fish. That's just the electric fish, because, you know, there are piranhas and their relatives there. The catfish go nuts. There are things that you'll pull up that don't even look like catfish that are catfish. There are things that you'll pull up that don't look like fish that are catfish. So it's madness. The Amazon River Channel, it's madness. It's incredible.
That's awesome. On your bio, there's a couple pictures of these electric fish. And I think for reference, because in podcasts, you kind of have to just imagine what we're talking about. I'll make sure that in the show notes, there's a picture of an electric fish. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have me and Dante Fanolio, we got a image on the cover of Integrated and Comparative Biology that has some very beautiful headshots of these electric fishes.
Well, that sounds like a super exciting time in your life. Now that you've got your PhD, where do you have your sights set in the future?
So I started in electric fish and I got kind of hooked on skulls. And now, to be honest, I really want to take over all the fish skulls. I want to do all the fish skulls. I'm going to figure out a way to include them all in one giant mega data set. And not just because I'm you know, a maniac, but because fishes are, you know, fishes comprise more than half of all vertebrates, right? So if you want to study skull shape evolution, you really need to be studying fishes. And fishes do skulls, you know, better than any other vertebrate group, in terms of just the shape diversity, in terms of coolness, you know, you name it, fishes do it. So if you really want to study skulls, you need to be studying fish. And my goal is to basically CT scan every fish skull that I possibly can and stick it in a data set and start asking really cool questions.
Oh, that's so interesting. So that's your big passion right now is fish and evolution.
Yes.
Could you give everybody a little bit more detail about how and why that's in, like, I know you talked about how you just said everything on Earth, like half of the things on Earth are fish. What are some of the things that you found with fish skull and the evolution of that has been interesting to you?
So far, what I found are like different patterns of what is called integration and modularity in development and evolution. In development and evolution, and integration just refers to the degree of covariation between different structures. So basically, if structure A changes, how much can you predict that the change in structure A will be reflected in structure B? Which seems fairly simple, but when you're integrating changes across an entire organism or even across a skull, it gets really, really interesting. And we found that differences in the developmental degree of integration and modularity, basically, which is integration is really strong covariation between part A and part B, and modularity is a very weak covariation between part A and part B. We found that differences in this can actually drive convergent evolution, which is the independent evolution of similar traits. So basically what we found is that, hey, we find these electric fishes with very similar skull shapes, even though they're not closely related. And then when we look at their underlying development, we find that the developmental programming is actually predisposed to producing these really predictable phenotypes again and again and again, despite not being very closely related. And so that was really cool. And basically, I kind of just followed that thread in my dissertation and onward. I kind of followed that thread. I was like, well, if they're convergent, what are they using their faces for? And that's how we got to the trophic ecology bit. And that's always been really cool. What I found, one of my more fun findings, is that like the lower jaw in these electric fishes evolves almost five times faster than the upper jaw and the rest of the skull. And what we found was that the shape of the lower jaw really, really closely tracks diet. So the thought is that the lower jaw is really tracking diet and it's able to evolve way more quickly than the surrounding structures.
So there's like evolutionary pressure for that lower jaw to do its, to change, to fit the food source.
Not only evolutionary pressure, my hypothesis is that the lower jaw is actually freer from constraints. It's less constrained than the rest of the skull, so it's allowed to more dramatically respond to these evolutionary pressures.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yep. My guess is that, honestly, this pattern might be reflected across all fishes. So I'm really interested in looking at that.
Very cool. Well, just to kind of wrap up that section, because there's some pretty technical terms. Convergent evolution. No, it's all good. Like that's why people listen to the podcast, right? They want to learn some stuff.
Convergent evolution is it's tricky to figure out what the underlying cause is. So basically, say you have like five things that are super unrelated to each other. So you can have, you know, birds, bats, and insects, right? They've all evolved flight, so all these things can fly. Now we know they're obviously not closely related, so we know that there's like a chance that this evolved independently. So that's convergent evolution, converging on a similar trait or function independently. So with these electric fishes, long and short faces have evolved many times independently, and they created this really nice pattern of convergence that we could then look into at the developmental level.
Okay, I gotcha. See, one of the things we ask our guests kind of in the middle of the interview is for a pet story, because this is the podcast, and that's P-A-W-D. Do you have a pet story you could share with us?
Man, I got so many pet stories. So let's get into this, right? So I have this black cat. His name is Venus.
His name is what, sorry?
And his name is Venus. Okay. W-E-N-I-S, like the skin on your elbow. And this cat has been, he's one of my buds. He is a wildly mischievous animal. There are many people on Twitter that can attest to the mischief that my cat has brought on them. he's very smart. He's very food motivated. I think last week my roommate in Providence shot me a text. He's like, dude, I need $15 because your cat, ate like three bags of my beef jerky. So, Venus is, that cat is very mischievous. And it was funny because, when I got this cat was kind of just thrust upon me in graduate school, because I was, you know, my friend just like dropped it off at my door. He was a kitten. And I was like, oh, little kitten. And I named him Theo. Right. And then I went to Peru and I came back and everyone was calling my cat Venus, because my roommates had decided to simply rename the cat. And at first I was going to change it back to Theo, but then he started acting like a Venus. And I know that, you know, your elbow skin doesn't act like anything, but if a Venus could act, it would act like my cat. So he earned that name.
And is the cat with you today? Like, is the cat still with you?
Yeah. He's in Providence right now. He's fine.
Oh, good. That's awesome. Hey, that's good. That's a cat story. The last couple of guests were talking about their dogs, so it's, you know, the cat people out there, they love hearing that people do adore cats just like them.
Yeah, man, I love cats. I love cats. They're incredible.
Yeah, they're pretty cute. my whole family loves cats. I'm unfortunately like super allergic to them. So that's why, I know. That's why we don't have a cat. My wife is very, very sad about that, because they just adore cats and we can't have them. I don't know what it is. I'm not as allergic to dogs. That's why we have a big Bernese Mountain dog, but, but cats just kill me.
Oh, dang.
well, thanks for sharing your story. That's super cute. Venus the cat, hey?
Yep, Venus the cat. Venus the menace, I call him.
So when you're not chasing down electric fish in the Amazon and chasing after your cat, what are some of the things you do for fun? What are some of your hobbies?
Man, I love basketball. I love playing it. I love watching it. I love watching it and then trying to do the moves. So I'm really, really big into basketball. I love playing pickup. One thing that if you know me, then you know this, but, I'm like wildly competitive. When a competitive person, like, it just like seeps into every aspect of their life. And sometimes you don't really want it to be there. So basketball is a really good outlet for that. I really love it. That's one of my bigger hobbies. I love fishing as well, which is probably not all that surprising, but I really love fishing. I don't like, for me, fishing is fun whether or not I catch a fish or not. And I really kind of fish just for species diversity. So I have like a hit list. Whenever I move to a new place, I have a hit list of things I want to catch. And I usually don't eat what I catch. I usually just catch it and let it go unless I'm hungry. So I love fishing. I love basketball. What else? What else do I like? I like riding my bike and I like working out.
Nice. Are you as devastated as the Canadians are that the all of professional sports is done?
Oh, of course. NBA playoffs are just ramping up. And I'm going to be honest, I'm not that devastated because my Golden State Warriors weren't in the playoffs. So now that the playoffs have been, you know, delayed, postponed, canceled, that means that technically we haven't missed a playoff appearance, which is really nice. So that's good. So I'll sit this one out. That's okay. But yeah, missing basketball, especially during this time of year, is always brutal for me.
Yeah, basketball was big in my life when I was younger and a younger teacher. Like, I played basketball in high school, and then I coached basketball for 5 or 6 years, the senior boys team. I remember how old was I? My family didn't have cable, and to watch NBA games, I had to go to my grandparents' place, a town over. And my brother and I would bug my mom, and she would drive us to my grandparents so we could watch basketball. And that was like during the heyday. It was during the heydays of the Chicago Bulls when Jordan and Pippen were together. And man, just watching those people, like, that was, I would dream about it as a kid, just watching how good that team was. It was an incredible time.
So there's a new documentary coming out in a couple of days, actually. Oh, maybe today, I think, called The Last Dance, where they've like delve into the final season of that Chicago Bulls dynasty. And it's incredible. And the crazy thing is, like, I'm young, right? So I was born in the 90s, born in 91. So I didn't really get to see Michael Jordan, like, or really appreciate him play. So watching him play, I was like, this is incredible. And it's just footage of him just shooting over people. And I could watch that all day. That's really something.
Yeah, I know that there's players today that there's always debates about, you know, this guy's just as good as Jordan. And they maybe do have a point. But I just remember that team. The quote that I love about that, the dynasty team of the Bulls, was like the benchers, the guys that were on the bench. If you could make a second team of just those guys, and they probably would make it to the playoffs.
The crazy thing is, the thing that really should put Michael Jordan in perspective for everybody is that Michael Jordan worked really, really hard, but Michael Jordan was frequently very distracted, okay? Like, Michael Jordan, he had gambling issues off the court. Like, Michael Jordan was a distracted dude. And you look at someone like Kobe Bryant, where Kobe Bryant, he lived and breathed basketball just to get, I'd hold him very close to Jordan in terms of the way they play and all of that. So he's very similar to Jordan, but it took Kobe devoting his entire life to doing that. Michael Jordan was so distracted, he took a year off. He took a year off of basketball, 2 years off of basketball.
He went to play baseball.
Baseball, came back and was still dominant. That's terrifying. Can you imagine if he like fully applied himself? What more could he be? He's already Michael Jordan, I guess. But that's really what should put Michael Jordan in perspective, was that to me, it didn't seem like he was trying that hard.
Oh, man. Yeah. The talent that guy had is crazy. And all time favorite movie for me, like probably my top 25, is Space Jam. So, that's just because I idolized that guy growing up. So, well, thanks for talking to us about your hobbies. The other thing I always ask guests about is there any causes that you're really passionate about you'd like to talk to us about?
Absolutely. So I'm really big into getting underrepresented minorities into STEM fields, and into especially kind of wildlife fields and biology fields in particular. Because I come from inner city North Philadelphia, and I know how easy it is really to kind of, because I'm from the inner city, you don't see that much wildlife. It's really easy to move through your entire life without thinking about wildlife. And if you want to diversify the perspectives in your field, if you want to really advance your field, you need to open it up to other voices. And you need to not only open it up, you have to make it accessible. You have to make an environment where, you know, people from these diverse backgrounds can come in and thrive. And I'm an African American, so I can speak to my experience. And, you know, my experience in academia was not always the nicest, not always the kindest. And not even all that comfortable. And so my cause is really helping to foster and create an environment where we can not only bring in these diverse perspectives, these diverse groups and voices, but foster them and keep them here. And, you know, have them and let them know that, hey, this space is yours too. And do with it what you want. And so I'm really big into getting underrepresented groups into STEM. That might be my biggest thing.
That's such a great cause. I can't speak to any of that because like I'm a middle-aged white guy from Canada. When you hit some of those roadblocks in your education, how did you cope with it? Like, was it just something inside of you that just powered past it? Did you have a support network? Like, I'm just, maybe people listening would like to hear that.
Yeah. So, it's kind of weird to say this, but you get a lot of practice, right? Like, you know, black guy moving through the field of marine biology, you rapidly find that you're the only person there. So you have to learn how to adapt really quickly. And you know, when I was faced with some of these hostile things, sometimes I would talk to friends about it. Other times I would just, you know, internalize it. Like, I remember that there was a racist incident that happened in undergrad where somebody had said a racially charged remark to me. And I internalized it, but I didn't internalize it in a negative way. It just motivated me because I wanted to prove this person wrong. And I did. It was about fishing. And, you know, I caught more fish than him and blah, 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 blah. And
this is awesome.
I caught more fish than him that day and caught a fish that hadn't been caught in that area ever. And there was a range extension and, you know, preserved and cataloged in the university collection. It was cool. But for me, like, I internalized a lot of that stuff, and it, you know, it gave me fuel, if you will, to, you know, to beat them. But back then, I thought that was okay. I thought that was the right thing to do. But the truth of the matter is, not everybody is super competitive, and not everyone should be, and not everyone needs to, you know, tolerate those kinds of working environments. For me, it was fine, but I might be in the minority with that. And I've had a lot of other friends who've had similar experiences, and they've shared their experiences with their support networks and things like that. And other times they've just, you know, reported them, you know? So yeah, it really varies from person to person. And sometimes it's not even, you know, it's not even like someone's said something or done something. Sometimes you just feel out of the loop. I remember sitting in a lab meeting at lunch, and everyone's debating, like, you know, like their favorite thing from Plato or some crap like that. And I was sitting there like, I don't know anything about Plato. Grown up where I come from, like, Plato means nothing to us. Like, Plato doesn't mean anything to us. What is Plato to, you know, your average inner city North Philadelphia kid? Like, nothing. And it's just like, it's just literally that kind of stuff. It's like, I could go my whole life in inner city North Philadelphia and never think about Socrates and be completely fine. So, you know, it's stuff like
Dr.
that.
Dr. Evans, I'd be right there with you. I know nothing about Socrates or Plato. Yeah. I would like to talk about Play-Doh with people. I could have a great conversation about that, but not Plato.
Absolutely. So yeah, and you know, I guess the point where it's like, but you feel like you need to know this stuff. For some reason, it feels like you're behind. And you can never catch up, which is, you know, is an awful feeling to feel. And it takes some time, and it, you know, that adds to your imposter syndrome. You're like, do I belong here? And yes, it's a whole thing.
Oh, and so I'm so glad to have you on the podcast for people to hear that message. It's an experience that not everybody gets to live, right? And until we don't, like, if we don't understand what each other, you know, each person as a human is going through, then we just can't put ourselves in other people's shoes, right? We're missing that empathy if we're missing stories. So I'm so glad you're advocating for diversity in STEM. That's really powerful having you as a role model. I mean, people must look up to you and say, wow, this guy did this great stuff. I can too. It must make you feel pretty good that you've accomplished what you've got through.
My mindset with that, to be honest, is that, you know, if I can do it, knowing, you know, cause I don't honestly view myself as, you know, some stellar, spectacular, you know, scholar or whatever. But you know, I worked hard. If I can do it, then certainly others behind me should be able to do it, you know, far easier. My drive and my goal is kind of to demystify the process going forward. Cause there was a lot of stuff that I didn't know about academia going into it. So, now I'm always trying to be as transparent about the process as possible whenever I talk to people about it. And just tell them things that, you know, they might not hear otherwise.
That's very cool. Well, thanks for talking about that. It's kind of a personal section, but super important.
Yeah, absolutely.
One of the things we always ask our guests kind of near the end of the interview is for something called the super fact. And the super fact is a story or something. It can be a story or it can be an actual fact that, you know, that when you tell people, it kind of like just wrecks them for a little bit. They just can't handle it. Do you have a super fact or a story you could share with us?
So what a lot of people may not know is that electric eels are certainly electric. They can zap the living crap out of you. But what a lot of people don't know is that when an electric eel feels threatened, it will actually leap out of the water towards you, towards you to make contact with your body and then shock the living daylights out of you. That's my super fact, that electric eels, a 6 foot long electric eel will launch itself towards you sometimes when it's threatened to electrocute you and stun you or, you know, do other damage.
That is terrifying.
It should be. It should be.
Did you get to interact with electric eels when you were down doing your field work?
Yeah, I saw them. So fortunately, I never encountered them in the wild, which is really good, because usually if you're in a position to encounter electric eel in the wild, you've usually made a mistake. But yeah, I've seen them because the fishermen will they'll catch them and then they'll sell them in the pet trade. And so I've been next to like very shallow pools with them in it. And things like that while I've been working in aquarium stores. So I've seen them in Peru, but never in the wild, thank goodness. I think we might have heard one once, because you can, we look for these electric fish with electric fish finders, which is basically a tiny guitar amp with an auxiliary cord plugged into it where we clip off one end. And since these electric fishes are constantly emitting an electric signal, all you have to do is stick that frayed piece of wire or cord in the water and you can hear them in the amp.
You can't turn That's it crazy.
Off. You can't turn it off, and they recognize, different species recognize each other with these electric signals. So if you know what the electric signal sounds like in the amp, then you know what you found. And the electric eel has a very distinct electric signal. And so when you hear it, it can be nothing else. And we heard it one time, and we got out of the water pretty fast. It was one time.
You're like, dang, yo, I don't want a 6 foot long danger noodle that's jumping at us to zap us.
Pass. We knew they could jump, so we just heard it and got out of the water.
Oh, that's crazy. That is an amazing super fact and a terrifying super fact. So,
yep.
Pro tip, do not think about getting near these electric eels. And even if you think you're safely away, they can still get you.
Yes, exactly.
Awesome. Well, we're at the end of the interview. Thanks so much for talking to us about these crazy electric fish and your exciting stories and field research and your powerful message of diversity in the STEM fields.
Not a problem.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Where can people find you on social media?
You guys can find me on Twitter at Stern Arkella. That's STERNACHELLA, Stern Arkella. Or you can, that's basically where I'm at.
Nice. And you tweet about different things in the field on your Twitter?
Yeah, so I tweet about fishes a lot. I tweet about birds versus fish because, you know, I don't like birds. I tweet about all kinds of science stuff and then some basketball stuff, kind of whatever comes to me. Nice. Yeah.
We don't really have time to get into it, but that's a whole thing on Twitter between the fish biologists and the bird biologists, right? There's like a big battle between the two.
All the time.
Hilarious. That's like, because I teach high school chemistry, I always bug the biology teachers, right? Like chem versus biology.
Yes.
It's probably a bit like that.
Yeah, and bird people are the worst anyways.
Oh, okay. We've heard it here, folks. All right. Well, thanks for chatting with us, Dr. Evans. I so appreciate it.
Not a problem. Thanks for having me.
You take care. Be safe and don't get shocked by those fish.
Absolutely. You be safe too.
All right. Bye-bye.
See ya.
Hey, everybody. I just want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, Genius Lab Gear. Genius Lab Gear is giving everybody 10% off everything at their store if you use the code BUNSEN10. That's BUNSEN10. Genius Lab Gear has a ton of cool stuff. We love that they sent Bunsen a bandana that says PhD Emotional Support Dog. It's so cute. Also, they have these little wallet-sized stencils for doing organic molecules. And if you're not a scientist or a science teacher, there's gear at the site that you would like as well, including Sciences for Everyone stickers and a whole bunch of other stuff. Check them out. That's at geniuslabgear.com. It's time for Woo or Wow on the Science Podcast, and I have Chris Good with me, who is actually
the principal of Lindsay Thurber High School, where I teach. How are you doing today, Chris?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no worries. You are new to Lindsay Thurber and starting, I guess, in September as our principal. How are you adjusting to the switch?
So far, it's really good. I have been a principal at Lindsay Thurber for a few weeks, but officially, I'm also still the principal at my old school at Barry Wilson. So, right now I've got two hats on, but it's certainly a good opportunity for me to learn a little bit about this new school. And I think it'll really help me be better prepared for September. So I'm really enjoying it. The great staff, great people to work with. Missing getting to know all the kids, but we'll have to wait until September for that. So
yeah, we don't really know much anything what's happening in September. I think that'll all be pretty fluid up until we hear from the government.
Yeah, I think that's true. We're sort of in wait and see mode, but we're definitely preparing for a bunch of different scenarios. And I think we're all just really hoping that everything continues to go well in terms of the pandemic, and that in September we can have as close to regular classes as possible. And definitely, we all really want to have our students back in the school, because I know all teachers at either school I'm principal at right now, that the most common thing is everyone's just really missing the kids. So
One thing that's kind of a cool story before we get going is your oldest daughter Abby graduated this year. And for those kids, grad was canceled, right? There was no dance, there was no banquet, but a whole bunch of teachers on the grad community and kids organized this parade where the kids paraded in vehicles in front of the school, and all the teachers cheered them on. And you were mentioning that Abby thought that was really fun.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, when everything kind of happened in March, and we kind of realized right away that there wasn't going to be a traditional grad, and that for the 2020 grads, things were going to look a little different. And that was really disappointing at first, but as a parent, and I know for Abby as a student, we really appreciate what the teachers at our school did. They pulled together some things to still really make it a really special day and to still make sure that the kids really had some great memories.
Well, okay, so let's move on to the trivia for people at home, and a reminder to everybody listening. I will be reading three statements. Two of them are fake, they're woo. One of them is true, it's a wow. And this week's category is fish. How confident are you with fish, Chris?
Well, I do love fishing.
Okay.
Not a big seafood fan as far as eating goes, but I do love getting out and doing lots of fishing in the summer. So I'm not sure if that'll help or hinder. I'll do my best.
Okay. All right. The first statement, all fish reproduce by laying eggs.
Reproduce by laying eggs?
Yeah, all fish reproduce by laying eggs.
So woo is true, wow is false?
That's right. And maybe wait to the end before you start kind of knocking them down. But sure. Do you have an idea about that one so far?
Yes.
You do?
But okay, I'll wait until the end.
All right. Statement two.
Fish can form schools with a maximum of around 1,000 fish.
And statement number three. Lipstick contains fish scales.
Okay. No. Okay. So we got the three. So now you want me to pick which one is false?
Nope. There's two false and one true.
Okay. So which one is true? I think it's the one that I think is true is that that lipstick has some fish scales.
Oh, perfect. Okay. So you think that's the true one. So the other two then you're leaning towards are false.
Right.
So your opinion is that there are some fish that don't lay eggs.
Correct.
Okay. And you think there are the second one about the schools containing 1,000 fish is wrong.
Yes.
Okay. Now, are they guesses or do you have ideas about that?
No, I'm just guessing.
You're just guessing?
Yeah.
It's going to make some vegetarians who are listening very disappointed if that last statement is true.
Yeah.
If they're trying not to use animal products. But let's see. Okay, final answer. Lipstick contains fish scale is true. That's the wow. Final answer.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So let's take a look at, let's go in order. Okay, the first statement. All fish reproduce by laying eggs. And you thought that one was woo. And you're correct. Most fish do lay eggs, but there are some sharks that give birth to live babies called pups. Cool, hey?
I knew that one I was 100% sure on.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So Baby Shark, do-do-do-do-do-do. Yeah. Have you had to listen to that song? Do you have any, like, little kids in, like, your extended family?
Yes, I do, yeah. So I've definitely heard that song a time or two.
All right, the second statement. Fish can form schools containing 1,000 fish. That is woo, because a lot of schools contain, like, schools of fish contain way more than 1,000 fish, up to millions of fish in an entire school. So that means you win. The third statement, lipstick containing fish scales, is correct. Now, it's not all lipstick, but some lipsticks, if the ingredients say pearl essence, it's most likely the silvery stuff found in fish scales. Mm-hmm. And it's also in nail polishes and glazes. Makes them shimmery. I'm not judging if you already know that about lipstick. I did not know that about lipstick before I did some research, because I don't really have a lot of knowledge about lipstick, but that's okay.
Yeah, well, I kind of thought that I knew that not all fish reproduce by laying eggs, and the second one I thought 1,000 to be did actually seem kind of low as far as schools of fish, because I thought there would be, you know, bigger ones. And then, so I thought the third one, I can't say for sure. So, but I thought it sounded like the thing that would probably be surprisingly true. So there was my logic.
You'll have to get Abby to check her lipstick if she has some, or your wife.
Yeah, I'll see if they have, if there's fish scales in it.
All right. Well, you know what? You're going to be a tough act to follow for any of the remaining teachers at Thurber that want to play, since the principal got it right.
That's right. Yeah, I'm glad I got it right.
All right. Thanks for joining us for Woo or Wow today, Chris.
Thank you for having me on.
Okay, take care. Have a good one.
Yeah, you too.
All right, it's time for story time with me, Adam.
It's story time, finally, because we actually have ideas now that we have a new puppy, Beaker. We're going to talk about stories that either happened with Bunsen or with Beaker,
or maybe just a little bit of a spoiler, maybe both.
If you don't know what story time is, you must be new to the podcast, because we do it almost every episode. But story time is, we talk about stories that have happened within the story time timeline, which is the past couple days or week. Mom, do you have any stories?
I sure do. So it was yesterday, and the dogs were outside with Jason, and he was playing with them, and I was ready to come outside too, and I opened the door out onto the deck, and then I was going to go down the stairs, and I looked out, and we have a spruce tree just to the north, and I saw Bunsen lift his leg to go pee. No problem, except there was Beaker almost running through the stream. And I yelled at Jason, Jason, Beaker is right by Bunsen. Go get her. But I don't think all of those words came out of my mouth, because it was like a slow-mo where she was just running through the pee and there was nothing we could do about it except she got peed on.
She got more than peed on. She stood under it. She was soaked.
Yeah, so I went to get a bucket, and we washed her off, and that was quite the moment. She, it was like Eureka, but she-reka.
Gross.
And it wasn't the first time, because then she did it again later in the day. So we're hoping that this is not a continuous trend, because the bathtub will be very, very busy if that's the case.
Fingers and toes crossed that Beaker doesn't get peed on again, because we don't want to have to deal with that again. She smelled kind of bad even after the bath. Dad, do you have any stories about Bunsen or Beaker or both?
Yeah, I can talk about how they play together. So Beaker's a puppy, and Beaker gets full of pee and V, which I don't really want to tell everybody what that stands for. But she gets a little spicy, and she wants to play. And she is not scared of Bunsen at all. Like, at all. He is, the size differential between them is enormous. And Bunsen, 99% of the time, is super gentle. He lets her bite him. He backpedals. He wheels. But the problem is that even though he's playing gentle with her, if he moves when she's moving the wrong way, he sends her, like, somersaulting and sky... Like body checks her through space and time.
He knocks her into next week.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. So he doesn't mean to hurt her, but he gets riled up too. He's a dog, so we have to be really careful with that. And what I read about that. I did the research. And even though Bunsen is so gentle, it's not like we let them play together unsupervised. She's just too little. And she got hurt by him the other day. She was running as fast as she could. And at short distances, I think Beaker's actually faster than Bunsen. But Bunsen's got longer legs. And Beaker veered left, and Bunsen just like ran right through her. And I think stepped on her, and Beaker squeaked. And we were like so worried about her. But she's fine. After she squeaked and she was a little dazed, she went right back to try to bite Bunsen's face off. So that's how they play. It's adorable, and Bunsen is a very gentle giant.
I'm going to also talk about when Beaker plays, but about something a little bit different, all right? So if you don't know, there's a character, Beaker, in The Muppets, and he makes a sound like, meep, 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 meep.
Oh, and she woke up.
And well, Beaker woke up. But Beaker comes to you when you make that noise, and she becomes really bitey. Maybe it's because she thinks you're an animal that's almost dead and just needs to shake you dead. But what she'll do is she'll look for anything that she can bite. Fingers, toes, hair. Hair is a big one. Ears, noses. Doesn't matter. But when she's playing with Bunsen, she bites his chest hair. And she latches on. Like Bunsen, like I've seen it. I've seen Bunsen like walk around trying to shake her loose, but she's latched on like a piranha. She is a leopard piranha because she's really fast. She can do corners well, which Bunsen can't. And she's got really sharp teeth. But yeah, if you're playing with Beaker, you gotta be careful. I think that's all the time that we have now. It's 4:07. It's the end of my section of the podcast. And I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
And that's the end of the show this week. Thanks for coming back week after week to listen to the show. This podcast would not be possible without our patron support. We so appreciate it, and we'd like to give the top-tier patrons a shout-out. They really make the podcast work. Our top-tier patrons are Andrea Persons, Bianca Hyde, Brooke Lavallo, Shelby Legat, Daniel Fry, Elizabeth Bourgeois, Judith Morton, Karen Beth St. George, Catherine Lynch, Kathleen Zerker, Mary Coos, Marianne McNally, Ben Rathert, Liz Button, and Rebecca Rutherford. Thanks so much, patrons, and also special thanks to Dr. Corey Evans, who talked to us about fish and the Amazon River. It was an amazing discussion. Until next week, folks, for science, empathy, and cuteness.